welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. This is a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. Deb's not here today. Kim is double-dutying, producing the show, and she is helping us on the air today. Thanks, Kim.
You're welcome.
So, today, it's been a crazy week, and we're going to break from format a little bit. I'm Michelle Boyce, by the way.
I'm Kim Gautreaux.
Yeah, we should let people know. And in the studio, we have Riley Murphy, who is a genderqueer individual who had with partner a problem down at Tim Hortons in Blenheim. Hi there, Riley.
Hello.
So we're going to talk about this, and for those of you who remember the Trails End incident about a month ago where an individual had transgendered employees and the owner of the flea market told them to take their business elsewhere because of it, because it is a, quote, family-friendly environment, unquote. You know, I'm getting really, really tired of that term, family friendly.
Like, whose family are they actually talking about? Because this includes my family, and my family involves queers, trans, like anybody. So
yeah, so this one tickled me the wrong way. It wasn't the funny bone. And I mean, I'm tired of people excluding my family because we're queer and in these environments, and I'm tired of people putting my relationship under a microscope. I can't touch my partner the right way, the wrong way. I can't kiss her the right way, the wrong way. I can't even give her a hug without somebody accusing me of groping her in public. And it's really getting on my nerves. So we've got Riley here, and we've got another family-friendly environment that this queer relationship has somehow violated someone's sensibilities. And so, Riley, can you just kind of tell us what happened? It was about a month ago at Tim Hortons, and run it down for us. Say, you were there with a bunch of people.
Yeah, I was there with Pat's mother and brother, cousin and some family friends. Went down there to get coffee. We were sitting out on the bench in front of Tim Hortons, and I don't know, we were just chatting, and I noticed a man that kept looking over at us, I wasn't sure who he was, but I don't know, he kept doing this for quite some time, and then after a while, he went up to the front and talked to one of the employers there. And approximately 5 minutes after he did that, the assistant manager came out and said that what Pat and I were doing wasn't acceptable, and really all we were doing was she had her hand around my waist, and you know, she gave me a peck on the cheek here and there. But, I mean, other than that, we didn't do anything since the family was there. But she said that it wasn't acceptable, and it was a family-friendly environment, and that that our type, quote-unquote, wasn't, you know, shouldn't be displaying that type of affection in, you know, at their location, and that that we would need to leave within, you know, 5 minutes or the cops would be called. So we left because we didn't want to create any more of a scene.
And you you left because you didn't, I mean, Pat's and her family have to live in Blenheim, and you didn't you didn't want to create that scene, and so you decided not to take it on.
Yep.
When did that change? And when did you decide to take it on? Because you've taken it on now.
Yeah. Well, I guess, when we went home, Pat and I talked about it, and of course we were outraged and, well, more shocked, I guess. And then when I came home back to London, which was, you know, a few days afterwards, I kind of was ranting to, you know, friends, and, you know, they said, well, I should be doing something about this. You know, I didn't really know what to do about it, but then, you know, I just, so I did post something on Facebook about it, and then I had some comments, and then, decided that mainly I didn't want it to happen to anybody else, and to probably get, you know, an apology for, you know, the way the assistant manager came at us as well, because she didn't do it very nicely. She did it quite rudely, so...
I'm not sure that there's a way to come at this, not rudely, but she could add a smile on her face.
No, but...
So you called Tim Hortons on this a few times, or sent them emails?
No, I sent the head office an email about it, but I never got a response back up, so...
So you decided that you'd take it public and... Mm-hmm. And get a response.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Awesome. So, the other inspiring part of this, because this one drops straight back into the LGBT community versus religion again, and I mean, the gentleman that complained, we've now identified that individual as Reverend Eric Reavy, who is the assistant pastor at Glad Tidings Church. And I had a phone call this morning. I've tried several times to get through to Glad Tidings Church to get them on the air and to give their side of this story, but they haven't answered their phone as of yet, and on the break I'll keep making that attempt and hopefully get them on the air to try and get their side of the story on this. But I did have a phone call that they're receiving quite a bit from another individual that did get through, called me and said that they're getting a lot of phone calls on this. And incorrectly, the original notice went out with the head pastor's name on it, and apparently he wasn't there. It was the assistant pastor of that organization that decided that he should take action at that Tim Hortons against you folks. So anybody that wants to comment on this is welcome to call in at 519-661, and I've forgotten the number. 3600, and I shouldn't forget our own number here at the station, but this has been a very long day. It's only 11. So Riley, what else happened? I understand that there was a prayer circle.
Yeah, after we left, about 10 minutes later, from, you know, what Pat's mother told us, she was still standing outside with Pat's brother and the cousins and the family friends, and I guess 10 minutes later or so, the pastor held a prayer circle out in the parking lot. So,
And I understand there was like 15, 20 people
attending.
Yeah,
that's what I heard, yeah. There's quite a group of them.
So, and I mean, I'm not going to, restrict... the pastor's ability to run a peaceful protest in the parking lot, because that's his right to have a prayer service wherever he so deems. But I mean, my problem comes in where this was actually identified as a prayer circle to pray for two individual souls, and that breaches a line, and that breaches where this individual is identifying two individuals personally, and And that crosses into hate speech type behavior, in my opinion. How did that make you feel when you heard about that?
Well, when I heard that he was praying for our souls, I was... well, I thought it was completely ridiculous, and I still think it's ridiculous. Because we don't need our souls to be prayed for, thank you very much. But, no, I just can't believe that he would take it that far. Well, he already took it far enough by complaining when we weren't really doing anything, but... Yes.
So I take it the conversation with the manager got rather heated?
Yeah, because we said to her that, you know, there have been numerous other couples, you know, that were doing much more than we were doing. You know, having full out make out sessions and whatnot, and you know, they never got complained about, and you know, and basically she said, well, you know, it was that wasn't, you know, it was okay in their eyes, but it was our type that shouldn't be doing that.
So she definitely identified you as a marginalized group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she definitely identified that she was booting you out because she felt you were a part of that marginalized group that wasn't welcome in their family-friendly environment.
Yeah.
So, you know, that takes you straight into the Human Rights Code.
Yes.
And you're planning on filing a human rights case, are you not?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And so, I mean... How do you feel as a queer person? Do you feel like you're under a microscope every time you go out in public?
Yes. Well, more so since that happened. Like, even before, you know, me and Pat, we would hold hands down the street, but that was the extent of it, because we're not one for public displays of affection anyways. But yeah, we think that we are being looked at more closely than, I guess, other couples, yeah.
So what do you say? I got another message today that said that you two were making out and groping each other's crotches.
Yeah, like, no. That would be very awkward and weird with her mother sitting right beside us on the same bench. So, no, we weren't doing none of that whatsoever. Like I said, we, you know, there was a peck on the cheek and, you know, she would hold my waist, but that was the extent of it since the whole family was there and, you know.
And you were just hanging out, right?
No, we were just hanging out talking with the family. There was nothing else that was...
And consuming Tim Hortons products.
Yep. Yes, we were.
So, and this happens a lot, I take it, with Pat's family? Hanging out at Tim Hortons?
Yep. Yeah, that's a usual thing that we do. And, like, Pat and I have been there before, and we have gotten stares, and but nothing has ever been said. Well, Pat's mother went there again after this incident happened, maybe a few days later, and we just walked down with her, but we didn't go inside the Tim Hortons. We didn't go, like, near the Tim Hortons. We stayed in the parking lot because, obviously, we're not going to go near that. But still, I guess one of the employers caught sight of us, and, you know, they were whispering and staring and... But so we quickly left that. So
it's my understanding that Pat's not really feeling all that safe as we speak, and things have gotten rather difficult for her family as well.
Yeah. Well, because Blenheim is such a small town, everybody knows everybody, and it's very hard for her right now. You know, even just walking down the street or, you know, going downtown, she won't even do that, and so...
So you guys spoke out about being discriminated and harassed.
Mm-hmm.
And now the town is further persecuting you? Yeah. That's what's happening down there?
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. Yeah, she doesn't feel very comfortable down there right now, and neither does you know, her mother, and so it's gotten a bit worse than we didn't expect it to.
Yeah, well, you don't expect an entire community to turn on you like that, and and you know, hopefully the politicians down there will start to step in. I understand the NDP has reached out to you, and and they're trying to influx some sanity down there into that. Gotta love our NDP candidates. So there is a planned Occupy Tim Hortons movement, kiss in, sit in movement. When's that planned for?
That's planned for Thursday. I'm not exactly sure of the time yet.
3 p.m.
3 p.m.? Well, there we go. 3 p.m. Yep. So, and I heard that one of the NDP provincial candidates is going to be there, Alex.
Something like that.
Yeah, Alexa. Yeah, so she's
come
going to be there.
Come out and meet her.
Yeah, I get to meet her, yeah.
Wonderful. Yep. And I mean, this is a peaceful rally.
Yeah. No, we don't want it to get out of hand or anything. We don't want anything bad to be done or, you know.
So the purpose is what?
Well, the purpose is for this not to happen again, and that, you know, LGBTQ couples should be able to go there and kiss if they want to, or hold each other if they want to, and not be discriminated against. So, you know, it shouldn't stop as soon as we walk into a Tim Hortons or.
Yeah. So. This story has kind of gone viral on the internet.
Yes, it has.
Yeah. I had a phone call this morning that unfortunately some individuals in the LGBT community or elsewhere, or possibly not members of the LGBT community, but people that want to create problems in this story, have apparently been calling members of the Glad Tidings Church and issuing threats of violence and stuff like that. And I mean, I don't think that in any way, shape, or form is what anybody wants in this.
No. No, I never wanted anything close to that. All we wanted was basically an apology from Tim Hortons and for this not to happen to anybody else, nor us again. So we didn't want it to get this far. So it's.
And it should be a safe environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just show people what family is with love, not these threats. They aren't
helpful
at all.
No.
So.
No.
Yeah, so, and we don't know where those are coming from. I mean, the one that I was identified came through on a Californian number. So who knows what was attached to that. But apparently Glad Tidings Church is extremely apologetic and very sorry for what has happened. So hopefully this can be a community building event and not tearing the community apart. I mean, I would love to see Glad Tidings there.
Yeah. Yep.
And you know, supporting, you know, the community and supporting, you know, love and happiness and people's pursuit of happily ever after, which we're big on this show.
Yeah.
Kind of our theme song, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So Thursday, Blenheim Tim Hortons. It's located at 79 Talbot Street West in Blenheim. You can go on Facebook and find it viral anywhere and everywhere.
And just for those who know, where is Blenheim located?
Oh, yes. The little town of Blenheim is south of Chatham, south of the 401, about halfway between London and Windsor on the map. So it's just a little town, very similar to the town that I come from, the mighty metropolis of Elmer, where where, you know, fortunately myself, I haven't had any run-ins with the religious communities there, and they've been extremely respectful of my family. So you know, and Elmer is known for its churches, and you know, it's really nice that that this kind of event hasn't been happening in my hometown with my family and my kids who go to school there. So. Thank you very much, Riley. It's really, really appreciated that you came on and told your side of the story. We haven't been able to get through to Glad Tidings Church, so unfortunately we don't have their opinions on this, and we haven't heard from multiple messages to Tim Hortons, who we would have also liked to have heard from for this show, but hopefully in the future they will step up and do the right thing on this. So thank you very much.
Welcome.
So, we're going to come on to a totally different topic at this point in time. And there was a conference in London on Friday, which was the Violence in the Media Conference. And it was put on by a whole bunch of people that I'll give you the list in a minute. But just to introduce some of Violence in the Media, I've got a clip for you here from Dr.
Kathleen Clark.
There have been over 3,000 studies of every variety, and these are scientific studies over the course of the last 30 years that show that watching violent and aggressive television in particular increases aggressive behavior and attitude. One of the studies actually showed that the kids who watched violent TV at an early age, when they got to be in their 30s, this is called a longitudinal study, the kids who did more watching of the violent TV at a young age had more jail records. So that's just one small study. Another really important study was one that was done in Canada in a little town that had no television, and they introduced television in that town, and then 2 years later they observed kids on the playground. So they had the observations of the children on the playground pre-TV, and then 1 or 2 years later, after having been exposed to television, there was more pushing, kicking, and shoving. So those are two particularly interesting studies, but there are many, many more.
So this is what we're talking about, and I mean, the conference was really, really amazing. Hats off to the organizing committee there. The Center for Research and Education, Western, UWO, there was the 4th R, CAMH, the Health Unit, TVPIC, which is the Thames Valley Parent Involvement Committee, and so many other organizers of this convention that they put together. And I go to a lot of these things, and it was really, really well done. The topic is a pretty pretty touchy topic. I mean, it involves our ads, our commercials. It involves our media, our video games, our kids, and they have profound effects on it. And we've got some interviews for you coming up. We talked to a woman who has actually taken this to family law court and got a decision against her former husband, who is an access parent, who apparently refused to let or have the 4-year-old had the 4-year-old exposed to teen rated and mature rated video games, and he felt that was appropriate, so she actually had to go to court, and she got a court order, so we have an interview with her. We have an interview with Katie Cole, who is a fantastic teacher at Medway, who talks about this issue and puts it in perspective of kids and how they're doing, and I thoroughly enjoyed her presentation, and here's an interview with her. So I'm sitting here with Katie Cole, who just gave an amazing presentation to the people here. Can you summarize what you're talking to the people about?
Sure. Well, today we're talking about the trending wave and how in media and with our kids, technology is always changing, and it's like we're being hit with new waves of technology, new media, new things, and it's really difficult to keep up. So I'm trying to give students and teachers and parents skills to become critically media literate.
You had some pretty damaging evidence there against some of the media out there. Can you talk about some of the big missteps that media makes?
Well, I know we saw a lot about video games, and we saw a lot about misogynistic attitudes, and sometimes when we're sharing too much online. I guess my biggest concern right now is with social networking and how kids are leaving their information online and how they're interacting with each other, sometimes in a cruel way online.
So can you tie this into the youth suicide rates and everything else? Does this fit into that?
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure it does. There's all impacts of media violence under, you know, our heading of violence, our umbrella of violence. We talk about depression and anxiety and even in some cases suicide when students are, you know, made aware of and are, I guess, I don't know how you want to say it, they're involved in cyberbullying online. So it can result in feelings of anxiety and depression and suicide. And it's up to educators and it's up to parents and it's up to their friends to help them deal with these instances of harassment or cruelty online and become confident in their skills and how to report it.
Now, we're always more concentrated on the people that are being subjected to cyberbullying. What advice do you have to parents who may have a cyberbully?
For parents who have a cyberbully or the kids who have a cyberbully?
Both.
Both, yeah. Well, for both of them, I do put some ownership on being an upstander. So we have friends on Facebook, we have 250 friends who are witnessing some of these inflammatory comments and bullying behaviors online, who do nothing and they just stand by. And really it only takes just a few clicks to report that person, to have that person removed from Facebook, to contact a school constable, to contact your Safe Schools Committee. And these are all actions that are pretty simple, and I think some people try to deal with it on their own without seeking assistance or help. And so I'm hoping today I've encouraged a few people to do that. If it's, you know, students to go seek help, students to block people, and for parents to participate as well.
And what about people that sweep it under the rug?
Well, people who sweep it under the rug, yeah, that's always difficult. I would hope that those people would come to a presentation like this and be able to, you know, see some of the consequences of negative media. They'd be able to see some positive media and in the future maybe make more positive media choices for themselves and for their children. Part of what we try to encourage is to get kids to be active audience members rather than just passive passengers. We don't want them to just ignore and let things get swept under the rug, as you said. We want them to engage with it, understand it, and then learn how to act appropriately.
Yeah, and Katie Cole is media studies teacher with the Thames Valley District School Board and writer for the Ontario Media Violence Coalition. In 2010 and 2011, she was awarded the Premier's Award for Teacher of the Year, and she's produced provincial curriculum for educators, parents, resources, and workshop materials to raise awareness and promote critical media literacy in homes and classrooms. So I got to say, Katie is one of the most entertaining and knowledgeable speakers that I've seen on this topic, and if you get a chance to hear her speak, then I would go out and engage that conversation. Here at CHRW, it's a fund drive, and fund drive is where we try and bring in the money that we need to operate the studio here. And I mean, this programming and this show, I've said this before so many times, this is a community radio station, and we get to put things and stories and information in front of you, the listener of CHRW, that we would never be able to do in corporate radio. And I can't give enough of a heartfelt thanks to CHRW and all of the team here for actually providing the space to put these messages on the air. And it's absolutely urgent that we get all of the fund drive money that we can in. And you can call us. We're here talking on the radio, but we're also answering the phones. And call us at 519-661-3600 and make your pledge. Anything over $20 is tax deductible, but we'll take $5, we'll take $10, we'll take anything. So give us a call here at the radio station and support CHRW because it supports us here at Between the Margins. So on with media violence and this campaign or this conference that we had, it's extremely important topic. And we've got a few commercials here right now, and we're talking more about the media violence in the media after the break. Welcome back to Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Kim Gautreau.
And we're talking about media violence. And we're talking about when violence becomes entertaining conference that happened last Thursday and Friday at the Faculty of Education at the University of Western Ontario. And I had the pleasure of actually attending that conference and listening to the presenters there, which did a really, really, really fantastic job of putting on a conference. And yeah, I'll push that subject because I go to so many of these conferences and they're so poorly run that that I just want to cry. And so when I actually go to one that that, you know, is so professionally run as this one, it's really, really something that I'm really happy about. And one of the presentations there is something that I believe in wholeheartedly, and we've talked about this before on the show, and that is the forum theater concept. And forum theater is a theater production, and it's been kind of invented by Tony Wilson at the London Board of Education. And this is a short 20-minute play that they put together with all kinds of oppressive behaviors in the play. And there's a cast of characters. There's there's usually one major oppressor and several other people responding to that oppression. And then what happens with forum theater is that you watch the play once from front to beginning, and then they reset the play, and then they go through it again, and the audience has the ability to stop the play when they hear oppressive behavior and things that they want to intervene in, and then they actually get to go up on stage and attempt to change the scenario and put a positive spin on it and for a better and more positive outcome. So if you want to hear about forum theater, there's a show on Between the Margins blogs it's about what show is that? I just totally escaped myself. It's a show on hate crimes, I believe, last spring. Bring it up. I'll tell you the exact show before the end. But you can catch all those blogs. Look for Tony Wilson's name down the list. It's at www.betweenthemargins.ca. And remember, this is Fund Drive, folks. So please call in and make your pledges for all of the important work that we do here at CHRW. The number is 519-661-3600. Or if you'd like to comment on any of the content in the show, you can do that as well. DJ is standing by the phone, and if you do get a busy signal, feel free to call back as soon as the line is available. So we're talking about media violence, and we're talking about various aspects of it. And And one of the aspects of it is the online presence. And I mean, all of our kids and us as adults we have an online presence these days. And one of the things that I teach people is how to keep themselves safe online, and not to put too much information up there when you're on Facebook or when you're on social media or you're posting information. I look at people's websites and I look at their social media, and they have their phone numbers up there, they have their address up there, and that's really not safe behavior on the internet. And I mean, sometimes they tell me, well, nobody really cares about me. I have really nothing that anyone's interested in anyways. And then the next thing they know is that they've posted to their social media that they're going away for a week on holidays, and then somebody sees that on their Facebook, and they come home and their house is stripped of everything because the perpetrators have their address and everything else. And they're like, oh, how did that happen to me? So we've got to keep ourselves safe on there. And that show is called The School Bullying Show, and it was on April 12th. So if you want to go to the blogs and look up that that piece on Forum Theater, there's actually an interviews with the cast of one of those Forum Theaters on that show, and so it's quite fascinating. So keeping yourself safe online. One of the presenters at the conference was a girl that we can only identify as AR. And AR, as a young woman, age 16, was victimized by an online predator who manipulated interactive media to victimize hundreds of young people in what many perceive to be harmless virtual world. AR described her encounters relating to the investigation, and we've got an interview with AR. I caught up with her after her presentation. So we're here at the Media and Violence Convention with AR, whose name's protected for your protection. And can you tell us a little bit about your story and what brings you here?
Well, when I was 16 years old, I met a guy online, and it wasn't really I was meeting someone online. It was a guy who actually knew who I was, and he basically followed me and got to know who I was. And when he had the moment, he took advantage of it and met me in person, and he sexually assaulted me. I kept it a secret for a year, did not go to the police because he threatened to kill me and he threatened harm. So after that, he hacked into my Hotmail account and he started doing what he did to me to other women, young girls, ages 9 to 14 all over the world, meaning parts of Canada, the UK, Mexico, France, and the US. So that's basically it. And he got 2 years, 11 months in prison. 10 charges. Sexual assault charge was dropped due to a plea bargain, and he's now out.
You're in protective custody almost, and how does that alter your life?
I can't really do anything anymore. I'm trying to do this job. I'm trying to change the laws, but I can't do that because I'm being protected. And, you know, it's good because it's for my safety. I have family. I have friends that need to be protected as well. I don't need him to go and attack them because of what I did. So that's why I'm keeping it under wraps and stuff.
So, I mean, we do a lot of advocacy work about changing the sentencing and the rules around that. Your comments on that?
I want them changed. If a pot grower is going away to prison for 15 years, why can't a pedophile? Why does it have to be 5 years? And why half the time do they not even get a sentence? They just let go with a charge and a fine. That's it. Now, I think it needs to be changed. I think it needs to be 15 to 25 years because pedophilia is just as bad as murder. You're taking someone's life away.
And you never really get over it.
Never have, never will.
thanks for talking to me. You hear it all the time. I know you hear it all the time, and keep doing the work. I mean, it's hard.
And keep doing what you're doing, because you're helping me spread my word. So thank you.
And we're back, and AR was a really, really poignant presenter, because she laid it out in a real world and real, as she says, she doesn't sugarcoat it. And it's an example of someone who was targeted online. These online predators, they don't just, you know, start talking to you online. They do their homework. And that homework, it's amazing what information you can get on somebody online. I mean, I try my best to control my information, but I'm a public figure. So unfortunately, that's one of the costs of what I do. But my children, I did an exercise with my daughter back a few years ago where I said, okay, I don't know anything about you, and I want to find out. So with a few keystrokes, I found out, you know, what she does for recreation. I found a few awards that she got. So I got her hometown. Once I had her hometown, then I had her school, and then I pulled information and I backtraced through her parent, who was me, and I got her address. And it took very few keystrokes for me to take the information that she had put online about herself, namely her first and last name, and it took very little work to get her home address. And people don't understand how vulnerable our kids are out there with the information and the pictures that they're putting out there. You know, so as parents, we need to protect our kids, and we need to protect them to the best of our abilities, but I mean, sometimes in the case of divorce, we lose the ability to protect our kids when they're at our ex's houses, and sometimes that relationship breaks down to the point where the courts have to intervene, and that's how far one lady, Jennifer Rommel, had to take it within family law, and we've got that interview with her.
I'm Jennifer Romeo.
So tell me about your case.
My case is that I have a son that I have sole custody of, and when he has access visitation with his father subjects him to violent video games that are M-rated and T-rated. Now, this has been going on since he's 4 years old. As he's getting older and able to articulate what's bothering him, when he has nightmares and tells me that he's remembering seeing the grenades and the dismembered bodies, seeing body parts flying all over the place, beheadings, that kind of thing, he's now able to articulate that that's what's bothering him. Whereas before, when he had a nightmare, I didn't know where the anxiety was coming from and what it was. So after trying to work with his father more and more about not exposing him to this, I wasn't getting anywhere. And he would laugh at me and say, well, take me to court. And they didn't really have a setup for this in the court system where you can get an order about video games and about media violence. And so what I did was I brought forward a motion, and it was ordered that my child is doing his access visits, that he shall not play nor be exposed to any video games rated beyond an E, which is everyone level, nor shall the child be exposed to any violent movies like Saving Private Ryan or anything like that, where there's very severe violence in that. I think at one point in that movie, somebody gets disemboweled and they have, you know, their intestines hanging out and that kind of thing. And so the court agreed with me and processed an order.
And when did you get this order?
August 3rd, 2011. So it's fairly new.
Wonderful. And you had mentioned earlier that this is not common, so it's never been done before?
Not as far as I know in London, Ontario. I don't know about Canadian law across all the provinces and territories, but as far as I know, this is relatively new here in London, and that it was difficult to get such stipulations in place because it's really kind of unheard of. But for me, I saw that there was a cause and an effect from being exposed to the violence, and with him getting agitated and with him having nightmares and so on and so on, I felt that it was time to take action, and I wouldn't leave the courthouse until I kept on getting a response and was able to file something. And so I did it myself, and I collected data from the internet and from Child Reach. I talked to a parent teacher educator over there who was able to help facilitate getting the information. Also, I have a friend that's a nurse down in Mississippi that has done blogs about the effects of media violence on people that already have mental health issues and how it intensifies their reactions and their behaviors. And so I took some of that data as well and entered that in. And one of the oldest pieces of documentation that I got was from 1978, was one researcher's thesis on how constant presence of media violence in a child's life, how it will affect them in a negative manner and have a negative impact on them.
Thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you.
So that's just an example of some of the lengths as parents sometimes we have to go to protect our kids. And you know, with the statistics that were out there at the beginning of this show and the correlation between the number of, criminal offenses that an individual has and how that compares to the amount of time they spend in online gaming, I mean... As a parent, the last thing I want is for my children to go head to head with the law, and you know, the research is showing that there's a direct correlation between them. And when we talk about the law, I had the privilege of talking to Staff Sergeant Robin McEachern at the conference here, and she's talking about AR's case and about the pedophilic laws and some of that frustration with the system where, you know, a pot grower gets 15 years, but a convicted pedophile gets 2.5. So here's the interview with Robin McEachern.
So currently in the OPP, I'm the working in the Aboriginal Policing Bureau. I'm the provincial coordinator for our provincial liaison team. I do a lot of work in terms of Aboriginal youth development, and in 2006 I was fortunate to actually implement and begin our youth issues unit in the OPP. It was the first that we'd looked at youth in particular with a large focus in cyber risk.
So you're here at the conference talking about risk and youth and in the media and these issues, and there's some particular laws that are in play with these kind of issues. Can you kind of Coles notes those?
Sure. So in terms of our laws, we have the huge area that has taken a huge focus is the online risk, and in particular sexual predators, as well as cyberbullying. And how do our Canadian laws address these, and how do we protect young people from these predators? We typically experience frustration in terms of applying older laws to new technology, and how do we make that work, as well as, you know, applying appropriate sentencing in terms of when things do go wrong and when things get through court, sentences that are reflective of justice and reflective of victims. It's very important for us to continue to be advocates for that.
AR was just talking to me about justice and sentencing, and her perpetrator only got 2 years, and how she's advocating for more appropriate sentencing. Where do we stand on that kind of thing within the system?
Well, what we do in policing is we just continue to build solid investigations. And I have to say that with the Ontario Provincial Police, we have one of the best electronic crime sections and an extremely dedicated child pornography, child sexual exploitation unit. And what they do is they continue to speak out in terms of the sentences. They continue to speak out in delivering quality investigations that really demonstrate the impacts that bring all of the information forward. So when there are images of child sexual abuse, it's ensuring that people understand that the profound effect of these images, that these are not just child pornography, which can sometimes not really elicit the true response to what is actually happening. And it's images depicting child sexual abuse.
Yeah, these kids, I deal with them at my agency all the time as adults. And they're 30, 40 years old, and it hasn't gone away. It's still there. It's still prevalent. And for the system to take these things so not seriously is horrific in my eyes, because I deal with the consequences of that later in life, and it's incredible how that goes. So hats off to you for working on that. What advice can you give parents to keep their kids safe?
I think my biggest thing for parents is to stop judging. You know, things go wrong, and things go wrong online, and you need to have that open window. There's a great speaker who used to say, you know, I used to stand in my kids' dorm room at night and watch them sleep and say, God, I don't want anything bad to happen to them. And he said, you know what? I got to the point where I said, God, when something bad happens to them, I want to know about it, and I want to be there, and I want to help them, because we can work through anything as long as we know. And it's really tragic when we have young people who are living with abuse and victimization, and they've got nowhere to turn, and they feel so judged because their world involves the online world that's so minimally understood that they've got nowhere to turn, and then they live with it internally. So it's so important that they, you know, when things go wrong, because they will, that we have that instant link to help, and that parents accept that that's going to happen and are supportive of it.
We see that so much right here in this conference. I sat and watched child after child come up and talk to AR there and disclose. How do parents make that connection without an AR standing there?
Well, you know, the biggest thing is that when your child is 16, you're way far down the other end of the line. I have little kids, and from the time they were big enough, we talked about what they saw on TV. We talk about what they do on the online, and I'm there with them. So that when they're 16 and they see me over their shoulder looking at what they're doing and being involved, it's nothing new to them. It's nothing foreign. Oftentimes we wait till we think the risks are there. Okay, they're 15. Now bad things are going to happen. We need to start young. We need to be involved, and we need to provide critical thinking. So we need to be their brain, and we need to get that knowledge ourselves, right? Because we didn't grow up with this as parents. Most of us didn't grow up with this. We don't know what lurks out there. And oftentimes it's just easier not even to think about it. So we need to go there. We need to be with them. We need to help them make the decisions as they go along. We need to start young.
It's amazing what you can actually dig up on our kids. And I know I've done the exercise with my children whereby I've